Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So, to start off today's deep dive, I want you to picture one of the most, like, high-stakes scenarios you could possibly imagine in modern medicine.
Oh, absolutely. It's intense.
Right. You're looking at a newborn baby, maybe just days old, and this baby is about to undergo open heart surgery.
Yeah, it's an incredibly delicate moment. I mean, right now, in hospitals all over the world, predicting exactly how that specific newborn is going to fare after the surgery is, well, it's notoriously difficult.
Exactly, because, you know, every baby's anatomy is slightly different. The way their bodies handle trauma is different. Yeah. But I want you to imagine a world where a baby's DNA could accurately forecast their post-op recovery before they even get wheeled into the OR.
Which would be a total game changer.
Completely. Think of going into complex surgery, like navigating a ship through a dark, violent storm. Right now, surgeons essentially have a surface-level weather report. They know the heart is structurally broken, and they know how to fix the plumbing, so to speak.
Right, the mechanics of it.
Yeah, but what if they had a deep-sea sonar mapping every hidden biological current, every jagged metabolic reef in that specific patient's body?
Well, that's exactly the paradigm shift this research is pointing toward. I mean, we're talking about transitioning from reactive medicine, where you basically wait to see if the baby's lungs fail after surgery, to highly predictive precision medicine right there in the neonatal ICU.
And today we celebrate the work of a massive collaborative team. This includes W. Scott Watkins, Mark Yandel, Martin Tristani Ferruzzi, and the researchers at the Pediatric Cardiac Genomics Consortium, or PCGC, who have advanced our understanding of congenital heart disease outcomes.
Yeah, we're diving deep into their article, which is titled, Genome Sequencing is Critical for Forecasting Outcomes Following Congenital Cardiac Surgery. This is published online in Nature Communications on July 10th, 2025.
So if we want to understand how big of a breakthrough this is, we really have to start with the baseline medical issue here, right? Congenital heart defects, or CHD.
Yeah, the scope of the problem is huge.
For anyone listening who might not be familiar with pediatric cardiology, like, how common are these defects, actually?
They're actually the most common type of birth defect globally. CHD affects more than 40,000 newborns in the U.S. every single year.
Wow.
Yeah, to put that in perspective, that equates to about one in every 100 live births.
Yeah.
It's a massive clinical burden.
That's way more common than I think most people realize.
Absolutely. And these defects represent a really complex class of disorders that are, you know, frequently life-threatening if they aren't surgically repaired within the first few days or months of life.
And when we say heart defect, we aren't talking about a single uniform disease, right? The physical landscape of these defects is just all over the map.
Oh, completely. It's incredibly varied.
Like, you might have a tiny hole between the upper chambers of the heart, or a baby might be born missing an entire valve. Sometimes the main pulmonary artery and the aorta are just completely wired backward.
Right, the transposition of the great arteries.
Exactly. And because the physical lesions vary so wildly, the surgeries required to fix them are incredibly diverse too.
And that physical diversity is exactly why this research is so crucial, but also why it's been so difficult. Historically, it's been nearly impossible to figure out exactly how a specific patient's genetics impact their surgical survival.
Because of all the noise in the data.
Exactly. There's a high degree of phenotypic heterogeneity, meaning the physical defects look drastically different from patient to patient, and an equally high degree of genetic heterogeneity, where hundreds of different gene mutations can contribute to those physical problems.
Wait, hold on. Because I was looking at my notes before we jumped on the mics today, and I saw something that confused me about how they actually set this up.
Oh, what was that?
It mentioned that cardiologists use something called Filer codes to systematically describe the anatomy of a malformed heart. And there are, like, over 3,000 different codes?
Yeah, it's an incredibly granular system.
Right. So if you have a study of around 2,200 kids and 3,000 different codes to divide them into, I mean, the math just doesn't work. How did the researchers actually extract useful groups out of that without entirely washing out the details of the individual patients?
Well, you've zeroed in on the exact bottleneck that has plagued this field for decades, honestly. If you rely on humans to manually group these patients, you either get groups that are too broad to be useful, or groups so small you literally can't run statistics on them.
So how did they get around it?
They bypassed it entirely by using artificial intelligence. They designed a two-pronged AI approach to standardize both the physical descriptions and the raw genetic data.
Okay, let's look at the methodology behind that, because the way they handled the physical diagnoses, the phenotypes, is just super clever.
It really is.
So they looked at a prospective observational cohort of 2,253 CHD patients. And for every single one of those kids, they had two distinct data sets, right? Their post-op clinical outcomes and their whole exome sequencing.
Yes. And we should probably clarify what whole exome sequencing actually is, because it's different from whole genome sequencing.
Good point.
So our entire DNA genome is massive, right? But the exomes are just the tiny fraction, about 1% to 2%, that actually contains the blueprints for building proteins. It's the functional mechanical machinery of the cell.
Right, so by sequencing just the exome, the researchers were focusing on the most likely culprits for major structural defects without getting bogged down in all the non-coding DNA.
Exactly. So returning to your question about those 3,000 filer codes, the AI was the first prong to wrangle them.
How did it work?
They used a machine learning algorithm called XGBoost. They essentially trained this algorithm on the clinical expertise of top-tier cardiologists. The AI ingested those thousands of complex, highly granular heart defect descriptions and condensed them into five clear clinical categories.
Wow. Condensing 3,000 variables into five buckets makes the data incredibly manageable. What do those buckets look like?
Well, to give you a couple of examples, the AI could categorize a patient into the LVO group, which stands for left ventricular outflow tract obstructions.
Meaning blood struggles to get out of the left side of the heart.
Exactly. Or it might place them in the HTX group, which stands for heterotaxy. And heterotaxy is a really fascinating and severe condition where the internal organs are arranged abnormally across the left-right axis of the body.
Oh, like the heart might be on the right side instead of the left?
Right. Or the stomach and liver are misplaced.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fundamental error in how the body organized itself early on.
Okay, so the AI cleans up the physical diagnosis perfectly. But what about the genetic side? Because every single person listening to this deep dive right now has thousands of genetic variants that make us unique, but the vast majority of them don't cause any disease.
That's the million-dollar question.
Yeah, so how do you filter out the normal human variation to find the actual problem?
That brings us to the second AI prong. They deployed a genome interpretation tool called GEM. And GEM scanned the exome sequencing data of these 2,253 patients, specifically hunting for what they term damaging genotypes.
How does it know what's damaging, though?
It doesn't just look for anomalies. It uses a probabilistic framework. It pulls in data from massive global genetic databases, looks at evolutionary conservation, meaning how unchanged that gene has been across millions of years of evolution, and it incorporates the parent's genetics if available.
So it calculates the probability that a specific mutation is the root cause of the patient's disease.
Precisely.
Okay, so we have our patients neatly sorted into five physical buckets by the first AI, and we have a highly curated list of damaging genetic mutations from the second AI. But bridging the gap is the real trick.
Yeah, connecting the genotype to the phenotype and the outcome.
Right. How do you definitively link those two isolated data points to whether or not a baby is going to spend 3 weeks on a breathing tube after open heart surgery?
They utilized Bayesian networks. This is a really formidable statistical framework, and it's vital to understand why they chose it over, say, traditional statistics.
Because traditional models are usually too simple for this.
Exactly. Traditional models, like linear regression, assume a straight line relationship between variables. But biology is almost never linear. Bayesian networks can model highly complex non-linear dependencies. They calculate the probability of an outcome by weighing dozens of interacting variables simultaneously.
So if you're listening to this and you aren't a data scientist, just imagine you're setting up a massive, complex web of dominoes on a table.
I love this analogy.
Instead of just knocking one over in a straight line, Bayesian networks let you map out the entire web. If you knock down one specific genetic domino over here, the network lets you calculate the exact probability of which clinical outcome dominoes are going to fall way over on the other side of the table.
Even if there are a dozen branching paths in between, it's a great visualization. And crucially, Bayesian networks allow the researchers to explicitly model uncertainty.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they can control for the baseline severity of the surgery itself. A baby having a minor hole patched has a totally different baseline risk than a baby having their entire aorta reconstructed. The network factors all of that contextual noise in.
The setup is brilliant, honestly, but the results are what really blew my mind. Let's dig into the key findings. Out of those 2,253 patients, the GEAM AI tool identified these highly damaging genotypes in about 10.6% of the cohort.
Which comes out to 238 participants.
Right. Where were these mutations happening in the genome?
The loudest signal came from de novo mutations in chromatin-modifying genes. A de novo mutation means it's brand new. It wasn't inherited from either the mother or the father.
So it just happened spontaneously during the formation of the egg or sperm, or very, very early in embryonic development.
Exactly.
And chromatin-modifying genes are heavy hitters. Just to give a bit of biological context here, we have about 6 feet of DNA stuffed into the microscopic nucleus of every single cell.
It's an incredible packaging problem.
Truly. To make it fit, the DNA is tightly spooled around proteins. That spooled package is called chromatin. The modifying genes control how tightly or loosely the DNA is wrapped, which dictates which genes are accessible to be turned on or off.
Right. You can think of chromatin modifying genes as the foreman on a massive biological construction site. They don't lay the bricks themselves, but they hand out the blueprints to all the other genes.
And if the foreman gives out the wrong instructions at the wrong time,
the entire structure of the heart gets built improperly.
Right. And the Bayesian network revealed that if a baby has a damaging mutation in one of these foreman genes, they face significantly worse outcomes after the surgeons try to fix the physical heart defect.
The numbers are stark.
Yeah. The study showed a 1.8-fold increased risk of mortality, a 1.7-fold increased risk of cardiac arrest, and a 1.6-fold increased risk of prolonged mechanical ventilation, meaning they were stuck on a breathing tube for more than 7 days.
And what makes those statistics even more alarming is how they intersect with specific physical defects.
Oh, like the HLHS group.
Exactly. The data showed this risk spike was exceptionally prominent in patients diagnosed with hypoplastic left heart syndrome, or HLHS. HLHS falls under that left ventricular outflow category we mentioned earlier.
And that's a really rough diagnosis, right?
It is one of the most brutal forms of congenital heart disease.
Yeah.
The entire left side of the heart is critically underdeveloped and just cannot pump oxygenated blood to the body. It requires a grueling series of open heart surgeries just to reroute the plumbing so the right side of the heart can do all the work.
So you have a baby facing one of the most physically traumatic surgical gauntlets in modern medicine. Add a mutated foreman gene to that baseline and the risks absolutely skyrocket.
It really changes the picture.
I think making that deduction completely flips how we view surgical recovery. The genetic mutation isn't just responsible for building the malformed heart in the womb. It's actively hindering the infant's cellular ability to heal from the surgical trauma used to fix it.
Yes. There's a critical layer to add to that because you're hitting on the core revelation of the paper. It proves that the physical lesion the surgeon is looking at on the echocardiogram is only half the story.
Right.
The baby's intrinsic biological resilience is written in their DNA, and until now, the surgical team was completely blind to it.
Wow. That brings us to the second major genetic domino they identified, which involves the cilia. The researchers found a strong signal with biallelic mutations in cilia-related genes. Wait, biallelic meaning mutations on both copies of the gene, right?
Correct. One inherited from the mother and one from the father. Both copies are damaged, meaning the cell has no functional backup to rely on.
Okay.
And these mutations were highly associated with those heterotaxy defects I mentioned earlier, where the internal organs are laterally misplaced.
The mechanism behind this is just fascinating because cilia are these microscopic hair-like structures on the surface of our cells. They sweep back and forth in coordinated waves to move fluid.
Yeah, they're like tiny motors.
Right. In human development, the sweeping of cilia in the early embryo literally directs the left-right asymmetry of our internal organs. That's why a cilia mutation causes the organs to develop on the wrong side. But cilia are also heavily present in our lungs, sweeping a continuous escalator of mucus and trapped dirt up and out of our airways.
Now, consider what happens when a baby undergoes open-heart surgery. They are placed on a mechanical ventilator.
Which means a tube goes down their airway.
Exactly. Which prevents them from coughing naturally. If that baby has a biallelic cilia mutation, their cellular escalator is completely paralyzed.
Oh, wow. If they can't cough and their cilia are paralyzed, the mucus just pools at the bottom of their lungs.
Yeah.
The care team literally can't take the breathing tube out without the baby drowning in their own secretions.
You've diagnosed the exact clinical nightmare. Now, the researchers noticed that this risk amplifies exponentially if you add a third variable, an extra cardiac anomaly. or ECA.
An ECA, what's that?
It's simply a birth defect that occurs somewhere outside the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a missing kidney or a malformed digestive tract. The study found that having an ECA acts as a massive risk multiplier.
How massive are we talking?
If a patient has a heterotaxy heart defect, plus an extracardiac anomaly, plus a damaging cilia genotype, the Bayesian network calculates a four-fold increased risk of prolonged mechanical ventilation.
Four times the risk of being trapped on a ventilator. That's huge.
Yeah.
But let me push back on the math for a second, because we do have to be careful with statistics here.
Fair enough. Good.
Some of these specific combinations, like having HTX, a double cilia mutation, and a kidney defect, that must be incredibly rare in a cohort of 2,200 patients.
It is very rare, yes.
So can we genuinely trust a four-fold risk increase if the actual patient count for that exact triad is just like a handful of kids?
It's an excellent challenge, and it highlights exactly why they couldn't use traditional frequentist statistics.
Mm-hmm.
Frequentist math relies on large sample sizes. It essentially says, I need to see this exact scenario happen hundreds of times to prove it's statistically significant.
Right. And if you only have three kids with that exact combo,
the frequentist model throws his hands up. But Bayesian networks don't demand a massive bucket of identical events. They look at prior knowledge, evaluate the relationships between all the interconnected variables, and map a curve of probabilities.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they thrive on quantifying uncertainty rather than demanding a binary yes or no. The confidence intervals around that four-fold risk might be wider because of data scarcity, but the mathematical signal of danger is robust.
That makes perfect sense. It's not claiming to have a crystal ball. It's giving the ICU team a highly educated, mathematically sound warning about the underwater currents from our earlier analogy.
Precisely.
Which leads to what might be the most surprising twist in the entire deep dive. We spend so much time hunting for the mutation that causes the disaster, but they found that the absence of these damaging genotypes is actually highly predictive of a better outcome.
Yeah, genomic data is profoundly valuable, even when it delivers a negative result. If a patient goes into complex cardiac surgery lacking a damaging chromatin variant, their relative risk for mortality drops to 0.55.
That's a massive drop.
And for a patient without a damaging cilia genotype, the risk of prolonged ventilation drops to 0.70.
I mean, if you're a parent sitting in the cardiology wing, knowing your child's baseline ability to heal is remarkably strong is a massive psychological relief.
Without a doubt.
So taking all this data, the AI sorting, the chromatin formin, the paralyzed cilia, how does this actually evolve clinical practice on the ground?
It clears the path for preemptive precision medicine. Historically, genetic sequencing results took weeks or months to return, long after the critical post-op window had closed.
Right, it was just too slow.
But rapid whole genome sequencing can now be turned around in a matter of days. Soon, intensive care teams will have this data before the first incision is even made.
So let's play that out. If the sequencing flags a biallelic cilia mutation before surgery, the doctors know definitively that this baby is going to suffer severe mucus pooling.
Armed with that foresight, the clinical strategy changes entirely. They don't wait for the lungs to fail.
Yeah.
They can preemptively initiate aggressive airway clearance therapies the moment the surgery ends.
Oh, wow.
They can administer mucolytic drugs to chemically thin the mucus or use inhaled beta-2 agonists. Crucially, the anesthesiologist can adjust their protocols, intentionally avoiding certain anesthetic and analgesic agents that are known to further impair whatever weak mucociliary function the baby might have left.
They are literally tailoring the anesthesia and respiratory therapy to the baby's DNA blueprint. It's incredible. But this all sounds almost too good to be true, and models are only as good as the data feeding them. What's the catch here? What are the limitations the researchers faced?
Well, we have to acknowledge the constraints of the cohort. This was not an inception cohort. That means the study only included patients who survived long enough to actually be enrolled in the study, get their blood drawn, and be sequenced.
A classic survivor bias. The babies with the absolute most catastrophic genetic lesions likely passed away before they could even be included in the data set.
Precisely. Because of that bias, the true mortality risks associated with these genetic variants might actually be considerably higher in the real-world population than what is reported here.
That's a sobering thought.
Furthermore, the clinical outcomes data relied on large national registries, specifically the Society of Thoracic Surgeons database. While these registries are gold mines, they rely on human data entry from dozens of different hospitals, which naturally introduces variability or missing data points.
Right, data entry errors happen.
And finally, there is currently no other global database with this specific massive depth of linked genomic and surgical outcome data. So the scientific community has to wait for independent datasets to be built to formally replicate these exact predictive models.
Okay, so we've navigated the AI sorting mechanisms, we've looked at the chromatin formin building the heart, and we've explored the sheer danger of paralyzed cilia on a mechanical ventilator. Bring it all together for the listener. What is the central driving insight of this research?
Basically, by utilizing artificial intelligence to synthesize whole exome sequencing with complex clinical phenotypes, we can generate highly personalized, mathematically accurate risk estimates for infants facing congenital cardiac surgery.
Beautifully stated.
This genomic data empowers intensive care teams to anticipate severe post-operative complications and deploy targeted life-saving intervention before the patient even enters the operating room.
It's moving from a defensive posture to an offensive one in the ICU. But I want to leave you with a thought that goes beyond just tailoring anesthesia. If rapid genetic sequencing can accurately predict that a baby's cellular machinery is fundamentally incapable of healing from surgical trauma, how does that alter the incredibly difficult conversations between surgeons and parents?
That's the real philosophical question.
Does having definitive proof of a grim biological reality change our threshold for deciding whether to even attempt a deeply traumatic, low-success surgery in the first place? It's a profound wrinkle in how we approach the limits of medicine.
It absolutely reshapes the boundaries of shared decision-making, moving genomics from a simple diagnostic tool to a foundational pillar of patient care. What does this mean for the future of neonatal intensive care when rapid genome sequencing becomes a standard vital sign, just like heart rate or blood pressure?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Recessive cilia out of